Hey, friend. Welcome to Houston Made, a show where I, Rusty Gates, get to talk with local Houston-based entrepreneurs and business owners about what it's like to be in the middle of that journey and selfishly gain insights as I build my own business. In this episode, I got to sit down with my new friend, Jacob Ibarra, the owner, operator, and master roaster of Tenfold Coffee right here in Houston. Tenfold is so much more than a great place to post up, work for a few hours, and have a great cup of joe, though it is in fact that. It's also a center of coffee love, appreciation, and education, as Jacob truly works to make the world a better place through coffee. When you enter this space, you'll immediately notice the attention to detail that runs through everything that they do, as well as an appreciation for life and natural beauty by the sheer number of plants that are all around. A while back, my broker actually rented out this space just as the shop was opening, and I fell in love, and I knew I wanted to have Jacob on as a guest, and he was kind enough to join me for an interview a couple weeks ago. So, listen in as Jacob and I discuss the importance of coffee education for consumers, how that education can literally change lives around the world, as well as the importance of finding a balance between innovation with a respect for tradition as entrepreneurs. Well, Jacob Ibarra, the owner, operator, master roaster of Tenfold Coffee here in the Heights. Man, thank you again for joining us and for being on the show. For people who don't know about Tenfold, can you tell a little bit about this space, where we are, what you do here?
Yeah, absolutely. So this space is the first of our kind of showrooms, you know, for the city of Houston. I've been in coffee my entire career. It's all I've ever done, and have been blessed to kind of experience coffee in multiple environments and places in the world. And that's a culmination of a lot of those experiences. And I hope we're kind of elevating coffee for the city of Houston in a way, you know.
Yeah.
This one is very centered around education and just exposing people to, I would say, the craft of coffee and to kind of counter just the consuming nature of it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the heartbeat of kind of this place.
Well, it's a beautiful space. And I know that for people who haven't been here, one, you should definitely come. It's both great coffee, but on top of that, it's an amazing space that y'all have created here. Really wonderful tables, a great atmosphere. And you've got your laboratory, Tenfold Laboratory, where you guys do weekly classes and education on coffee tasting, coffee and profiles, all of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The classes have been, they are a key part of what we want to do. Clearly the pandemic made that quite a bit challenging, but, you know, again, it's taking what I've been exposed to and trying to bring that to a level where it can be approachable, right? You know, for us, it's, I think coffee is a beautiful craft. There's a lot of lives that touch it. You know, my background's a procurement, so I see it all the way from the farm level to existing in communities here in the U.S. And those classes are a way to kind of break some of that down and show maybe some of the intentionality, some of the care, some of the creativity, behind coffee, you know? And so we've really focused on two, I would say, classes for the public. One is coffees from around the world, and it's really just showcasing like what's out there.
Yeah. And the diversity, like there's all kinds of, it's not blonde, medium, dark anymore.
Exactly,
the world
totally
has gotten smaller, and there's a lot of profiles.
You know,
there.
We start like really traditional, like not going to scare anybody. And then I'll put some coffees that taste like Fruity Pebbles, you know, and it's like, people are like, what, this is coffee? And I'm like, yeah, you know, it's like, that's where the world is getting to. Farmers are getting to, and then the other class is more towards just people, helping people brew better at home. You know, I think the reality is that people are already messing around with four or five key variables, but probably just not in a way where they know how to really manipulate or adjust that to get a better cup.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's just showing them how that kind of science experiment works.
Yeah, you know? For sure. Yeah, it feels a little bit like messing with like the EQ on the stereo sometimes.
Exactly.
Like, I don't know, just slide it around until it sounds good. So, but yeah, you talk about these five variables when you're making coffee at home.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't have the ability to adjust those variables.
Sometimes you don't.
If you're using a hot water kettle, like there's that.
Yep.
If you're not paying attention to temperature or grind or all of that. So educating people on what that is, because it could be
absolutely overwhelming.
Totally. You know, and that's what I don't want, you know, like I don't want it to be something that's scary, something that's, just too much, you know, and sometimes it's really like, it's really as easy as suggestion of like, well, go get a $30, $40 kettle that can hold mm-hmm. the temperature.
Yeah.
And that'll make a whole lot. Or use filtered coffee or filtered water. Sorry.
Yeah.
And you will notice a difference.
Yeah.
You know, it's like little things, mm-hmm. you know, and they'll make this kind of effort. And then usually what you find is like, if somebody's willing to take that step and they have a good result, they're down to kind of take the journey, you know?
Yeah. Well, again, I feel like ever since the infomercials that were asking us to give money to like poor kids in Africa, sure. everything has been measured in the cost of a cup of coffee. It's like for three cups of coffee. But the reality is that a $40 kettle, it's like, well, if you drink coffee every day and you're doing it out and you're buying yep. it at a retail store, like that's not, you're a week of coffee.
and
you can have years of great coffee that are so much better.
Absolutely.
So it's approachable.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, unfortunately that I think you've just nailed or hit on something that is a dynamic that, so we're in specialty coffee. It's this sphere of coffee that, you know, sits, there's a, we try to distinguish ourselves from commodity coffee, which is kind of lower grade.
Yeah.
You know, we are not separated from the globally traded price. Like everything kind of sits, kind of in comparison or in conjunction with that. But we try to differentiate ourselves by quality.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, some of those comparisons are challenging because like we're trying to elevate the value of coffee. You know, I think that that's the only way that we can impact the supply chain in a real way. And so showing somebody how to better brew a coffee so that they can have a better experience at home, hopefully leads to a greater appreciation in coffee, just in general.
For all of it. Yeah. For all of it. Not just what you're getting in your cup, absolutely. But for the industry, for the farmers, for the procurers and the art of procurement. So I know you graduated from Texas A&M.
Yep.
You went to Costa Rica, which is where maybe this deep love kind of started. Were you doing construction?
I was in construction, man. So my brother and I, we went out and we worked for an orphanage.
Okay.
And we just did construction every day.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, like the orphanage, it sat on a river, and as you went down the river and came back up the other side was coffee fields. Mm. You know, and I had never been in a culture that was just so infatuated with a product. You know, I grew up in Texas, but I imagine maybe this is like the Midwest or something, you know, when you breathe and live an agricultural product.
Yeah.
Dude, we would have coffee brewing in the morning. We would have a cafe break at 9:30. We would have coffee at lunch. We would have coffee at 3 PM, you know, and then at night there was a pot brewing, you know, and then in the harvest time, all my buddies would go and help their fathers pick or work a farm, you know? And so it was just all around you.
Yeah, that was life. It was ingrained into what they were doing on there.
Dude. And they were just so proud of it. Like it was like Costa Rican coffee is the best. And every Tico would like, you know, believe that. And it's like, and it's cool, man. You know? And it like, I left there knowing coffee would be a part of my life, but not really understanding quite yet what that would look like.
Yeah.
You know?
And then what drew you to Seattle? So you transitioned your Costa Rica, you to Seattle, obviously it's the like supposed mecca of coffee. And
it was kind of the perfect blend, to be honest. So I was a psychology undergrad at A&M. And I thought still that I would do something like counseling, coffee. You know, one of the things that really attracted me to is like the cafe, you know, that communities gather, that, you know, you put a cup of coffee in front of two people and they pause, you know, they stop. All of that really spoke to me. Mm-hmm. And so I actually went up there, twofold, more because it's coffee infatuated and then also to get a master's up there. Mm-hmm. And so I went to a school that was trying to blend theology and psychology. And so, yeah, still was kind of thinking I'd be a counselor, coffee, something. But then within a couple of years, I was like, just give me whatever degree I can.
Yeah.
And I want to do coffee.
Yeah.
And so from there, I kind of dove deep, man. I was always a barista, and then I started roasting it for a large specialty company up down there, or up there in Seattle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I have a buddy who, is a roaster up, he was a roaster. He just stepped away from the roastery, at Purple Door Coffee up in Denver, is nonprofit. They're doing work with, formerly homeless teens and giving them jobs and job training and all that. And he's one probably
the closest friend that really educated me. And
okay.
At the time, and this was 2010, was kind of explaining to me like third wave coffee.
Yep.
Right. So you started out and it was, like you said, purely commodity. It's just instant coffee, Folgers, whatever. Like coffee is coffee. You just get it in.
Yeah.
And then it, like the step up from there, I forget what second wave was. It's like, second
wave is usually people like Pete's and Starbucks, where they started sourcing better coffee, but maybe their roasting practices didn't change too much. So it was still darkly roasted.
Got it.
You know, and if that
just
makes...
Just burn it to hell, throw it in there. It's like, hey, we got it from this really great farmer. You won't be able to taste any of that.
Yes. But. So the cooking didn't follow. And I guess to understand that, you need the kind of the precursor, which was an inferior product, which kind of dictated a burning of it because it was like defective. It was foul tasting. And so the only way you could cook it and it to be palatable was to burn it.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the history, right? Like we developed a culture and a practice that has kind of changed one element at a time. And so when I was coming on the scene and in 05, it was like, oh, we can actually cook this.
Mm.
And each coffee tastes differently.
Yeah.
And wildly delicious.
Well, and did the technology change? Because, like, my understanding is now, like, you can, like, look inside the bean while you're roasting. And you can do, like, kind of, there's so much more than just, like, well, it looks done.
Oh, totally, man. You know, so refractometers started showing up. Software. So when I first started roasting, there was no software that you could plug into the roaster. Now we plug up software that follows, basically, it's a graph between heat and time. And you roast. I mean, we're still manual controlling everything, but you're roasting to a recipe almost. Mm. It's in graph form, but it's got all your notes.
Yeah.
So, you know, we might roast the same coffee 8 times in a given week, but we have a reference curve profile, however you want to say that, that we roast to so that we have consistency throughout 20 batches or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's cool now, man.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
I mean, I say all the time that when I, like, doing real estate, I couldn't have been a realtor like 20 years ago. Mm. Like, that was a different industry. The game was completely different. The technology, not having the internet to have all the listings and everything, like, it was a different job.
Sure.
And I imagine, I mean, I have to believe that there were people who took roasting seriously and saw it as an art and a craft, you know, back in the 80s.
Totally.
Like that was happening. But the type of art that was,
dude,
was
totally
a dramatically different art.
That's it. You know, like, and even on the buying side. So, you know, that's where I've spent most of my career is the purchasing.
And that's when you went to Australia. So you went from Seattle
to
Australia. And that's when you started in buying and procurement.
Yep. And I, you know, I took those steps because, you know, there are a lot of importers in Seattle because it's a big coffee culture. You know, I got to expose myself to that world as we were a medium-sized company, I would say. This is Cafe Vita up in Seattle, but our roasting and buying team was really small. So you get to kind of get all that insight, you know? Mm-hmm. But I guess the point I was making is, like, on the purchasing side, when you travel with men who have been doing it for like 40 years more than you, like, their battles 30 years ago are way different than our battles now. You know, they were trying to get regions of a country to just stay regions. Whereas I'm looking at like plots of land and being like, please isolate that plot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. A couple acres.
Like, yeah. Plant only this there, you know, that kind of thing. And so, it's interesting, man. You know, I think one of the things in our zealousness, we still need to have appreciation kind of for what was, you know? And I think that's, in general, I think coffee is still very young. The people who kind of get into it are youthful, you know, and energetic. And I think that sometimes the appreciation side
maybe a disconnect from the legacy that came before you. That I appreciate that. And I think it's a good testament to entrepreneurs everywhere. Mm. I think that most people who get into entrepreneurship, it's because they think, well, I could do it better. I could do that.
Yeah,
whatever. Which we need a little bit of that.
Totally.
For innovation. Challenging. That's how industries grow and develop. Somebody was like, you know, I think a computer could help us out a lot.
Yeah.
And there was probably an old guy around be like, no, we don't need any computers. And yet, having a respect for all of that and appreciation. I have a tattoo on my leg. It's like this ancient Jewish quote says, forgetfulness leads to exile, while remembrance is the secret of redemption.
Cool.
It's this idea that the Jewish people in the Old Testament, they were constantly getting in trouble when they forgot where they came from. Mm. that was always the beginning of trouble is when they forgot what God had done. And And that was, that just meant a lot to me spiritually, but also like as a person to remember that like I am where I am today because my parents gave me opportunities and they laid a foundation and opened doors for me that I could have never opened for myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that we always have to remember and pay like as much honor as we can to that legacy and then build and develop.
Absolutely.
I know they both would be really upset if I had just like done what they did.
Yeah.
They wanted me to go out and do things.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're even tapping on something that's maybe a little bit more American, our challenge for Americans, you know, where, I mean, it leads to a lot of great entrepreneurship, but I feel like in a lot of these producing countries, you know, your Central and South American countries, I think it's easier for generation to build on generation to build on generation without the need to go and create something completely different.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's interesting, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
Cultural difference of family and the way we look at time.
Totally. No, that's it. But, you know, even taking it back into coffee, you know, Starbucks is kind of the quintessential example of this, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, you can kind of hate on Starbucks, but there wasn't a coffee cafe culture in America before then.
Certainly.
You know, like I wouldn't be able to do this without them, you know, without that work.
Yeah. Without the doors that they opened and the appreciation for coffee. And that was the stepping stone. It had to be.
Yeah.
We had to go through that to get
here. And honestly, I would be dumb not to pay attention to what they do currently even, you know, there is a mass cultural kind of acknowledgement, especially here in the South, that I know I need to be sensitive to or I'm going to probably not be thinking in the appropriate way for my business.
Yeah.
You know,
they're a big company and they're still a player and they affect what happens down here.
So. Yeah. And it's, you know, and I'm not even saying like you follow that, but it's like, how do I position myself so that I'm either better or whatever that looks like, that decision looks like, but you have to be aware of it.
I just had a couple episodes ago, had a really similar conversation with Andrew Mitchum, who is the owner and brewmaster of a little nano brewery up in Jersey Village called Senate Ave.
Cool.
And we talked a lot about that, of that Carbach and St. Arnold, like he loves those places. That's where he was visiting.
Yeah.
He was dreaming about opening a brewery, and that he has to pay like homage to these brewers, because there wouldn't be microbreweries and nanobreweries out in Cyprus in Houston if it wasn't for those two major players saying like, yeah, we're gonna do it
and yeah
open the door,
we're gonna push, we're gonna set up distribution for sure, man. And that's that's it,
and it changes. Okay, so you go to Australia, so you were in Seattle barista, you were learning more and more about it, you got to see some of the inner workings. And then you end up in Australia doing procurement for a pretty established company. It's Five Senses, right?
Yep. So Five Senses is kind of the equivalent of like an Intelligentsia or Counterculture over here. You know, they're probably close to 25 years old now.
Yeah.
You know, they're across the country. We had a joint venture in Singapore, and just a great group of human beings, you know. Was really privileged to kind of work there. And in Seattle, most of my time was roasting. At the end of that, I was like, okay, I need to figure out some sales experience. That's not my natural kind of inclination. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go do this in Australia.
Yeah.
But very quickly, because of my experience, I got pulled into the kind of the procurement side. And so within 6 months, I was, you know, kind of making trips and helping out. And, you know, that looked like covering Central America. And I became that buyer, or covering our high-end micro lot program. And then eventually that just, you know, some of this was very fortuitous as well, because the buyer at that time was on her way out. And so I basically got groomed to take over.
Nice.
And man, that was awesome. You know,
is it as glamorous as it sounds? Like, you're traveling, you're jet setting around the world and taking these little buses to these middle of nowhere farms.
Bro, I was on the road 3-4 months out of the year, you know, in these countries. The non-glamorous part is like, you can be in the mountains of Colombia with cold water, you know, like, and, you know, or you can be in Africa in bed because you've eaten something and your stomach's destroyed, you know?
Yeah. That's the side that we're not seeing. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, I loved it, you know, and I still love it, you know, like I'll be in Guatemala next month, you know, what I love about coffee is the kind of groundedness. Like we get to showcase it here in the cafe. But the reality is most of it's at a very, like, some might say backwards level. It's like agricultural product. I mean, it's people battling the weather, the earth, the
geopolitical.
Dude, you know, it's like, there is something very humbling about that, you know? And it's, I think what was amazing for me is because of the size of the purse that I went and bought at, you know, I also got to do a lot of good, you know, it's like, and that's where here's my little rant, but like, I believe specialty coffee is a way for people to have better lives. Mm. You know, there are a lot of mechanisms like your organics or your fair trades or your Rainforest Alliance that try to accomplish that as well. But I think at the core level, what I've seen to be the most successful is just quality.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it's not an easy thing, you know, to take somebody from a commodity minded thinking or and improve their quality. Like, and there's investment, whether that's energy or money. But if they can figure that out, then they can demand more for their product. And if they can do that over a couple of seasons, well, then they can leverage their name a little bit. And if they win a competition or if they kind of position themselves in an appropriate place, dude, they can do really well, you know, at that point. And so I just believe that specialty coffee is a way for a lot of people trapped in a particular type of lifestyle to kind of find their way out.
Yeah.
You know,
which then plays to the education piece, right?
Because absolutely.
So to increase demand for these farmers all over the world and for their product, there have to be more people that are asking for great coffee from unique, interesting places. In the same way that we have wineries all over the place now because demand is high.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. It's a product. We're talking grapes.
Yep.
And they use that grapes. And again, the plot of land and the quality. And
absolutely.
And absolutely. It's going to be a commodity. That's as well. Like, there's bad wine. And there's always going to be bad wine. There's people who are like, yeah, it's fine. We'll just grow it in bulk and we'll blend it all together and
totally.
Be okay. And yet, the idea that if you take the time to be intentional about what you're drinking, where it comes from, how it's being made, that can actually sow good into the world. On the opposite side of the world.
Totally.
That's really cool, man.
I mean, that's the dream, right? You know, you would almost be cold hearted to travel as much as I have and to not want to contribute. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Like, it really is like that. So, and to be fair, that's the whole basis of Tenfold. You know, that's the purpose behind it. You know, we, as an educated human being, somebody who's been very blessed, like you talked about your parents, but like, you know, like I was the same. My parents didn't finish college, you know, and, but I was blessed to be put in a position where I could educate myself and grow. And, you know, I've been all over the world and I'm coming back to Houston with a mindset of how do I creatively position Tenfold so that it is that showroom or so that it is that voice or that advocate to increase demand, like you said. Yeah. But also just bring somebody into that experience at their own pace, you know, and make it stick, you know? And so that's really the basis of everything we're trying to do here. And our whole strategy is really built around that, you know?
Yeah.
We will produce creative spaces that make people think about coffee in a different way, whatever we build, you know, even if that means less of them, you know, that's the hope.
Yeah.
And we know that if we can do that well, do that creatively, then we can sell more coffee. It's kind of the goal. And if we can sell and move more coffee, it's not about making money necessarily, but then I've been in the position where I can go into communities and be like, okay, I know your bulk coffee is this, scores like this. I can charge you this. But if you bring me coffee that scores in this range, well, I can give you a premium.
Yeah.
And if you can get coffee scoring in this, I will put your name on it and give you another premium.
Yeah.
And then you can help incentivize kind of
development, growth. Yeah.
You know, and I've been blessed to be in that position. And so it's like, and I've seen that work. And so I really, that's what we're trying to get at, you know, and it's, that means choosing less countries to work within. Mm-hmm. That means choosing less producers. And if we're buying from estates, then I want to choose people who I believe, because one of the other things that's really important is like you need people on the ground in these countries committed. Either because they're from there or because they have a heart for it.
Yeah.
Helping those around them that maybe are less fortunate, you know? And so that's who we're choosing to try to work with as well. So that our impact looks significant, or at least is positioned to have a greater impact, you know?
So when you try, I mean, so some of this was, you were given some relationships and connections to begin with because it was a part of the job. So when you talk about being groomed, like that was some of it was like, hey, we're going here. You're going to meet these people. And
then,
so for a decade plus now you've built these relationships, but what does exploration look like when it comes to finding new families, new farmers?
Sure.
Like, is it, you just kind of like be like, hey, we're gonna spend a few weeks here and we'll travel around and ask the locals. What does that look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, when you go to a country for the first time, it's like traveling to a country for the first time, right? Like, it's like you do your research. In this sense, it's like the way the supply chain works in most of these countries is that there are exporters everywhere. Yeah. And so an exporter generally would have their own networks. And so maybe at first you go to an exporter and you, let's say you go to their office and you taste through, maybe a selection of coffees. And then you're like, oh, I like that one. Oh, I like that one. Tell me a little bit more. And then your trip kind of evolves around going and maybe visiting those.
Yeah.
You know, at this point it's, I've got more relationships than I can bring to Tenfold right now, you know? So it, and I'm finding this as an entrepreneurial, challenge is I just have to focus, you know, like there are a lot of opportunities, a lot of avenues that you potentially could go, but like kind of staying true to vision, staying true to what you want Tenfold to kind of be like built on, you know? And so, but yeah, you know, as relationships develop, now it looks more like going to a country, visiting the farmers that you have partnered with, and then maybe exploring a new region or maybe exploring a new farm, like so that there's always a little bit of exploration because even in the best of times, like sometimes a farmer, like for example, one of the farms that we work with, I was just told that their production this year is going to be 2/3 less than it was last year.
Wow.
So luckily they're going to safeguard a little bit, but it's a pretty big coffee for me. It's my biggest purchase every year. And it's usually half of our espresso blend, which doesn't change.
Yeah. Yeah.
If in the event I had to go and find new coffee because I know my needs, then that's when exploration is really important. Because if you don't have any of that time spent in like looking for new relationships, then you're kind of stuck.
Yeah. That way you're playing from behind the ball, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Like there's just no way you're like trying to play catch up and hey, and then again, when you talk about the intentionality and choosing the right people, not just the right product.
Yes.
You have to kind of have just some of those ready to go if and when the opportunity arises.
That's it. That's it. You know, and yeah, you know, and I think it's also cool because I kind of consider it my responsibility to be savvy in this market and to actually create revenue streams that drive the moving of coffee.
Yeah.
Right. So, we're going to be going hard into cold brew next year. We have some other kind of more creative orientated coffee stuff offerings that we want to move into as well. And it's like, if I can do that well, then I can go build new relationships or step into more relationships, you know? So that's where I think exploration really gets fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's this really interesting balance between being really focused and be like, we can't do everything.
Yeah.
So we got to pick a few things and we're going to do those things really well.
Yep.
While also keeping an eye on what could be next. So the most of your time is spent there, but there's a little bit. I think, what was the book called? There's a book I read as a part of like a business assignment that I had at one of my previous jobs. They were like professional development. They're always kind of be like, hey, spend some time reading. And one of them was, I think it was like the innovator's dilemma or something along those lines. And it essentially said that is how do you like produce one product and get it to where, and then there's just their whole idea is that typically within technology, you can produce overproduce a product to where it gets so good and so expensive that it's actually not even, doesn't make sense for the public market anymore.
Yeah, dude.
And then now you can be like, and that's true. Like I think about computers, like it's like, yeah, we can make amazing computers, $20,000 computers. Well, not a lot of people buying those.
I mean, this
So I came back to Texas in 2018, and I feel like I've had to learn this lesson over and over and over and over again, you know, because it's like you get out of a job and it's just like it's an open world mm-hmm. at that point. And you're just like, oh, I can do everything. I can, you know,
yeah.
And I've got a consultancy side too. And it's like, but really you're limited. Your time is limited. And I actually think that that makes us better. I think it has its advantages, even though it looks maybe negative, you know?
Yeah.
I think focus is a great thing, you know, and it really puts like, what is it that you value, you know? But I still find myself kind of falling in that trap, you know?
yeah. People talk about balance, and I don't know if it's always that. I think Terry, the trainer, was a previous guest, and he was saying, he's like, I don't want balance in my life. He's like, I just know it's about rhythms. He's like, there are seasons where it's really busy and you're all over the place. And then there are seasons where you just have to pare everything down. It's like, okay, we got to do this for a little bit. And then, I bounce back and forth between all of that.
Yeah.
I get excited and I'm like, I'm going to do everything. And then I spend a week where I'm just working nonstop and be like, okay, I'm going to just have to stop everything for 3 days now.
Yeah. So for me, it's like, what's sustainable, right? Because like, I've basically burnt out at where I'm at now, where like the last 6 months have been super hard, not because I think the business is actually getting easier,
yeah.
but I'm just so tired from running at such a pace, you know, and you don't know when you're starting a business, like you feel like you're running a sprint, but you forget that it could be a marathon.
Yeah.
And so like, that pace is after a while, it's destructive, you know, and so now it's more like, and that has forced me to be like, okay, so what are the systems? What are the culture? What are the people that we're putting in place to build this so that it's more robust, so that it's not just on, so I have a business partner too, I should say. So it's not just on us. And so that ultimately, like, I've been thinking about that, it's that old African proverb that is, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go long, go as a group.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I'm consciously thinking of right now.
Yeah.
You know, and as an entrepreneur and as a startup, I would say it's challenging because it often is that kind of chicken before the egg. Like you kind of have to build the cash in order to hire the people so there is that, I feel like, stressful point, but it's like with a goal in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's for a season. We are going to sprint for a little bit, but so that we can get to a point up ahead and take a breath and slow down, and then we can go together. I can absolutely appreciate that. So the real estate thing and the media company has just been really successful. I've been really fortunate.
Cool.
Last week I was out shooting video for Rent Ewards and Segway. And like today I had some social media stuff. I'm doing some marketing work for a company in the morning, and then this interview, and then video work tomorrow. And I also have a video due tomorrow. So I told my wife, I was like, hey, I'm going to get home tonight, and then I'm going to lock myself in the office, and I'm just going to work until that's done. So I'll see you on Friday. and I was having the same thoughts when I was sending those text messages to her of like, this is great. I'm so grateful for these opportunities. Super exciting.
Yep.
This is how it's got to be right now.
Yep.
It can't be like this forever.
Nah, bud.
Nor can it be like this for a couple more weeks. I'm looking at December and being like, yeah, okay, we're gonna get through a couple of weeks of this and then take a breath and then reevaluate and see.
Absolutely.
How do we slow down or leverage some other people to make this more sustainable? You mentioned your business partner, which I think is a good segue. When you started this, my understanding is you had two other business partners. Right, that you started all of this with.
I have one other business partner. I have one that we call a founder he's actually here this week.
Okay, cool.
That probably offers kind of his heart and his ears, kind of as a consultant,
okay.
You know, from time. My other business partner lives in Australia, Singaporean by birth. His name is Yuseng, and he is in his 60s. And had a rich career, you know, in a lot of industries, private equity. He managed the Commonwealth Fund of Singapore in Hong Kong. Like he's done some very cool, large scale stuff, you know, and, you know, in all fairness, I'm probably a project for him.
Sure.
You know, in a lot of ways. And,
I'm pretty blessed to have somebody like that, you know, and interestingly, the fact that he's overseas and has been kind of trapped in Australia through the pandemic, like, we were birthed in the pandemic and he hasn't been able to come over here since we've opened, has almost given us, he's very level-headed with his experience, but also like there's no emotion tied into it where I clearly am tired or exhausted and have a lot of emotion with it. And it's been a really interesting balance to kind of navigate a lot of different things, you know? And so, he's the whole financial side, kind of setting up the architecture, the structure, the systems for that side. And I'm the operations side, you know?
So, and how does that kind of a relationship come about? Cause I'm, you know, a lot of the people that I've talked to on this podcast so far, it is kind of ground up, grassroots. They have a product and people like it. So they go to markets, they sell it. Maybe they do well enough that now they've got some distribution and they're hiring people to make the products for them. And there's all of that. But it does seem like that there is this kind of partnership. I don't want to call it a shortcut, but I mean, it's definitely a different way of getting into it, saying, hey, we're going to start out with maybe some capital or with enough collateral to get a loan or whatever. So how do those conversations work? How do you identify a partner and say, this relationship, or you had a really great idea? And he was like,
Well, it was kind of, I'll tell you my story and I can maybe suggest how I think it should work, but I'll just, better off just saying how ours worked. You know, so I had always had the dream of starting something, you know, it was kind of one of these things where every time I traveled, it would kind of bubble up. You know, I'm a Christian guy. When I moved to Costa Rica, I was really like, I didn't want to just work to work. And so I was kind of praying and thinking through and had a few dreams at that point that I feel like never really left me. And, you know, as I got into my mid-30s or my early to mid-30s, I started really thinking about that and traveling. You know, you kind of have this wanderlust. You start thinking about what could be. And I actually went to him because he was a friend of mine at the time's business partner. And I just wanted some wisdom. I'm just like, I can't get rid of this. I know I probably should start it soon if I'm ever going to do it. And that was one of the first things he told me is like, your opportunity costs are going to be too high. Like, you're going to be either making too much money, you're going to have too many responsibilities. I already had one kid, you know, like, to take that risk. And so, that's how it started. And, we just kind of eventually that led into, I will partner with you, you know, and, because he's private equity, he was the one that kind of guided us through. We raised money. We, you know, we've got other partners in the, in the business.
And at that point it's, we've got an idea, we have a concept. Here's the plan. And that's when you're talking to people and you're saying, hey, do you want to be a part of this?
You know, you put together a whole like business plan, a whole deck of, if you want to say something that's, you know, in that deck, it looks different to different groups. Like when you're looking for a real estate and you don't have a concept to show somebody and yet you're trying to negotiate TI or whatever, you know, it's like, no, but this is what our experience is. This is what we think it'll look like, feel like. And then when you're trying to raise money, it's the same thing. You know, it's the, got to show people something, you know? But yeah, he was very influential in these early stages. And I think that's where, you know, I would probably suggest if you're looking for a partner, look for a partner who doesn't have the same skill set as you, you know, that would be clearly what this is like. He is clearly of a different time period, which has its own challenges and advantages. He also comes from a completely finance background, which has its challenges and also has some real cool blessings. And yet we relate enough on what we want Tinfoil to be that, you know, for the most part, we stay in our lane. But clearly it's like, I'm here, he's not. If there's financial questions, then I might have to step in, you know, and sometimes I get in trouble with him too, you know, and we, but we meet weekly, we pray weekly. You know, we're talking about what we want Tinfoil to be for the future. And I think that's really crucial in these early stages, you know, and our plan with him was for him to be kind of in the day-to-day for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And to kind of then step out and kind of be more an advisor. Like, so we are probably about 2 years away, you know, and the idea is that we build a financial team that he kind of oversees, but then, you know, he's doing less of the day-to-day stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how it's worked for us.
Yeah.
You know, I think it could look a lot different if it's two like-minded people, but I think you got to be real careful as to whose responsibilities are what, yeah. because at that point it's like, well, why are you partnering? I think, you know, at least that's how I look at it. I do think there is some advantages to having somebody by your side. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just less lonely.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of times when, you know, I look at leadership really, you know, it's really easy. If you had a problem and you were coming to talk to me and seek mm-hmm. advice, it's really easy for me to kind of offer that and to be careful with my intent and words, but to be like emotionless.
Yeah.
But when you are making decisions on a day-to-day basis, it's like, that's all I do every day. Mm-hmm. And my heart is attached to it. That's what I actually think leadership is. Mm. You know, it's like it. And so, I don't know, having somebody there to talk to through that and to, you know, because you can just self-doubt.
Yeah.
Like, even something simple, you can think 1,000 different things to it,
yes.
you know. Or you can be super attracted to something, and we've had this circumstance, and he's just like, Jacob, no. You know, but I'm like, but I can do this. You know, it's like, but no, why?
Yeah.
You know, like, and so I love just
a
that.
Little bit of accountability.
Yeah.
Second set of eyes. Yeah.
So I think if you are willing to maybe take some sacrifices in the early stages, I think you'll probably be propelled farther mm-hmm. with potentially a partner.
Yeah.
It's kind of how I view.
Yeah. It's definitely something that appeals to me as a solopreneur, both in real estate and yep. media. And, you know, obviously, you know, Randy, and so my broker, and he's been a guiding light for me throughout real estate. So yes, it's my business. I'm doing that, but I kind of had someone to bounce stuff off of.
Yeah.
With media, I mean, I've had to go find friends.
Mm.
There's a guy that I found on TikTok who's out in Florida. I was making videos. They were a little, like a few steps ahead of where I wanted to be, but seemed about like career wise about where I was. And so I didn't feel bad about reaching out and be like, hi, can we be friends?
Yeah.
Cause I need someone to be able to text when I don't know how to like fix my camera or I'm looking at a piece of gear and I don't know what should I buy? What should I invest in? And I've just had to go out of my way to like find those relationships because being a silo, I would just never do anything.
Yeah, dude.
I would be like, I don't know. I don't know. Therefore, I'm not going to do anything. And I'm certainly not going to spend thousands of dollars on a camera. I don't know if it's going to work.
Yeah.
And
no, that sounds really wise, man. You know, because I think there's a lot of people who don't do even that step, mm-hmm. you know. I think the reality is we need people.
Yeah.
I mean, at the core level of it, you know, I think that it's just maybe some people less, but I think we really do. And I think we're going to be better off inviting the right people into the equation, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, man, as we kind of get towards the end of our time here, you've had this really awesome journey. I feel like if you want to write a book, I think you could.
Yeah.
I think that people would read that, listen to an audio book on their travels. But, is there advice that you would give to that younger Jacob who was sipping coffee for the first time in Costa Rica or figuring out the business side of things in Seattle for the first time?
You know, it's hard to say because I feel like if I'm talking to myself, it's like you could have moved a little quicker. But at the same time, it's like, dude, that's what made me.
Yeah.
You know, so you kind of give yourself grace, but I'm kind of the one that like, you know, I felt like I need to prepare myself and maybe that makes even this first year in a pandemic work as well as it did. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I hadn't taken that time, you know, maybe I couldn't have done this in the pandemic, you know, so it's hard to say, but I think personally it's like my gut's usually in the right place. And now I think I could maybe move with a little bit more speed, but, I feel like I've taken all those experiences and, kind of building what I want to see and
in the world, you know? And, I would say if I'm talking to other people,
yeah,
I would say do something with purpose, you know, do something that, as corny as it sounds, makes the world a better place.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the beauty of being an entrepreneur. Like, you get to create in this world something that you want to see, something that you, potentially helps other people.
Yeah.
And I think that at the core level is what will also create longevity.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think you need to do something with purpose in order for it to be, I don't know, have a lasting impact.
Yeah, well, and I certainly believe that when you kind of come at it a little more cause motivation, a little more being a little more cause driven, that the experience of it will be different. Your experience of it will be different.
Absolutely.
When you were talking about being able to go to these producers and say, hey, you're making it here, but if you can deliver it at this quality, then I can do XYZ. I just imagined how beneficial that kind of challenge is, you know, if you've been producing at a lower quality for a generation.
Yeah.
And like, you just can't just get bored. And, Andrew Mitchum, the brewer, and I were talking about this, of just like how awful boredom is for like a person, like for your soul. Like, and my definition of boredom is, and this is one that I have a 5-year-old son and a 3-year-old son. I tell them this all the time, is that like, is boredom isn't the lack of things to do. It's the belief that the things you have to do are not worth doing.
Yeah.
And so it's like, they're like, we're so bored on things. Like, I have given you the world. You could do so many things. And they're just like, I was like, so go build with your Lego sets. Well, I don't want to. And it's just like, in that moment, they don't see any value in it. And if I say, how tall can you build a Lego tower? Immediately the challenge, like something switches in their brain and they go like, oh, watch me.
Yeah.
And I think that saying like, hey, you can say, yeah, I want to start a business. And if you're doing it for yourself, I want to start a business. I want to make 6 figures, whatever it is. Okay, great.
Cool.
But then you might catch that goal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it's the dog catching the car. It's like, well, now what? And that's where I have seen that, like, those kind of emptier goals, you attain them and all of a sudden you're just like, oh, this sucks. Why have I been doing all this?
Well, and I would probably argue that being an entrepreneur probably isn't the quickest or easiest way to make 6 figures.
Also valid.
You know, like, I'm like, there are days when I'm like, oh, I could have kept that job, you know, and had a lot more free time, you know, but I love what I do. I love what we're building, and I'm excited about the future, and I'm completely fulfilled and super tired. Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah.
Well, Jacob, dude, thank you so much for the time. Tenfold Coffee, you're doing amazing things here, both with coffee, education, and obviously around the world. So we'll definitely push people your way. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
A huge thank you to Jacob and to you for listening to this episode of Houston Made. If you haven't done so already, go find Jacob and the shop on Instagram at Tenfold Coffee, all one word. And then check out their website, tenfoldcoffee.com, where you can learn about all the regular classes they have. They're an excellent way to try some great coffee, learn more about brewing at home, and meet some wonderful people in the process. Otherwise, just swing by the shop sometime. I promise you, you won't be disappointed. I wanted to give you a quick heads up that this is actually the second to last episode of season 1 of Houston Made. So far, I've had the chance to talk with 22 entrepreneurs across 31 episodes, and it has been a joy. I'll take a short break and return in early 2022. But in the meantime, I'll be doing a limited edition merch drop as a way for you to support the show and the small businesses that we highlight here. So be sure to follow me on Instagram at Rusty J. Gates and the show on Instagram at Houston Made Podcast, so you can hear all about that and support what we're doing here. Houston Made is hosted by me, Rusty Gates, produced and edited in collaboration with Luke Bronner. Our artwork was designed by Stephanie Leal and Sarah Olwegvi in collaboration with Mac Ryan Creative. Credit for our theme music goes to Old Friends, New Friends. Houston Made is glad to be a part of the Million Media neighborhood of podcasts and storytellers. We are people who care deeply about human connection, and in our neighborhood, we find that connection by hearing and appreciating one another's stories. To find more shows made by amazing storytellers from all kinds of backgrounds, visit millumedia.com.